Welcome to another episode of Celluloid Citizens. As always, I'm Sean M. Thompson.
I'm Brian O'Connell.
And on the episode today, we're going to be discussing Takashi Miike's Audition, the 1999 romantic comedy, rated R, starring Ryo Ishibashi, Aihi Shiini, Shina, Tetsu Sawaki,
really,
John
mostly
Kinemura.
Yeah, mostly.
And, based on a novel by Ryu Murakami, and the screenplay was by Desuki Tengen.
Yes.
I'm sure I pronounced all of that wrong. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I didn't know it was based on a novel.
Yeah, apparently it's based on a novel.
Just found that out now. But,
It's just in, listeners. I'm getting a note under the door that Emily's meeting was canceled, so we're good to go.
Wonderful. Great.
We're like cable news, yeah.
Yeah, this happens live.
This happened live, yes.
Yeah. Audition. This is a film that I've heard about for a very long time, but only got to watching recently. And I see why it's so infamous now that I've seen it, because this is quite impactful scenes in the...
I think another huge thing, too, is in the late 90s, early aughts, we had this explosion of Japanese horror that ended up making its way stateside.
Right, yeah. With, like,
you know,
Ring.
I would say stuff like The Grudge, Ju-on, or The Ring, Ringu.
Right.
And, of course, having their American counterparts that were made didn't hurt.
Yeah.
But I think Audition was one of the first I can really remember hearing about that was just sort of like whispered about, like, oh man, did you see that fucked up Japanese horror movie?
Yeah, well, it definitely came sort of at the start of that wave, 1999, slightly earlier.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm not saying it's the first one, but I am saying it was one of the first big ones I remember hearing about.
Yeah.
I've subsequently seen a lot of Miike's films. He had one he did for Masters of Horror, that show on Showtime.
I've heard about that.
I haven't watched it. I think it was known as Imprint, that actually ended up getting banned, which was sort of weird because it was on Showtime. So you'd think, why? Like, you know. But I ended up watching it. They sold it on DVD, but they couldn't air it. It was weird.
Right. Yeah, that is odd. But
he's a really eclectic and versatile filmmaker, because I would argue most people know him from Audition, right, but he's done like gangster movies, he did like a musical comedy, he's done just like absurdist stuff with like Visitor Q, and
I've heard mixed things about Visitor Q, but
he's had a number of just interesting or just truly weird movies that he's done, so I would say Audition is one of his best, and it's definitely one of the more cohesive.
Yeah, it is. It's funny that it's cohesive, because it takes so many turns within the film itself, not just in terms of plot, but in terms of genre and style. You introduced it as a rom-com, and can I just, I tweeted about it, and it was like a joke or whatever, but I actually do feel that Audition is a sort of rom-com, even in
just
that
a very
extra
dark
bleak
one. Yes. Yeah.
Even when it gets extra dark into the last third of the movie, it has a strange, I don't know, it's there's a dark comedy to the whole movie that and the tone shifts in general are just really masterfully executed.
We recently covered The Handmaiden.
Mm-hmm,
of course,
mm-hmm.
Listeners, when you hear this, this will have been months ago. But
right.
But yeah, it's similar in terms of people wearing masks. But in this case, it's probably a little less playful about it.
No. Yeah, it's not a fun twists where you're surprised and exhilarated. It's nasty twists.
I will say this about Miike, man, his violence is just like ugh.
Yeah,
he has a thing
heavy
for needles.
Yeah. That's the thing. I mean, I've been wanting to... This is actually the only of his films I've seen. The one I'm really curious about is obviously Ichi the Killer, which I hear is just extremely, extremely violent and to like almost cartoonish degrees of violence.
Yeah, yeah. It's a different sort of violence. It's more like, excuse me, it's more like the, well, it's like the difference between like The Shining violence or Evil Dead violence.
Right.
Like,
right,
one
right,
is yeah. more meant for laughs, the other is, like, meant to be a little more serious.
Yeah, yeah, it's not, this actually uses violence, Audition, I mean, uses violence very sparingly, but, when it happens, it hits hard, you know, it's treated with weight.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue, and we've had this conversation off air, you know, since I'm a writer and I write violence a lot, violence, I think, ends up being more effective if it is sparse. I'm not
right. Yeah,
it's not that I'm saying I'm prudish. I'm saying, you know, anything that it's basically diminishing returns. So, like, you know, with the sex scene, for instance, like
right.
There's nothing wrong with having like 10 sex scenes in your movie, but if you have one that's really powerful,
yeah,
that can sometimes take the place of like three that are just sort of mediocre.
Yeah.
And the same thing occurs with like extreme violence or even just violence.
Of course. It's different with, I mean, it produces different effects. Sometimes you want that sense of numbness or boredom or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, like, as much as I shit on war films, I don't inherently have anything too wrong with them. So yeah, I mean, something like that, the tedium of violence would be used to good effect in a war film, say, where it's just like you see so much violence that like you, like the character, become almost numb to it.
Yeah. It's purposeful in different ways. But in Audition,
it's meant to be just like a slap in the face. So it works better at where it is, like at the end.
Yeah. But let's, I think the best way to talk about this movie is just to go into it. So we get a, you know, and this is interesting. There's a brief prologue at the top of the movie that, honestly, it feels like something that a lot of the horror films from the 2010s have sort of cribbed or, you know, paid homage to in a way. Where it opens with, you know, an event that is sort of superficially unrelated in a major sense to the action of the story, but it's an important character moment and tone setter. You basically see this man, Aoyama, who is with his wife on her deathbed. And she dies and his son comes in and it's just this sort of, it's like a tragic moment, right? And
yeah,
I mean, or maybe not tragic, but poignant. And it's, you know, it reminded me of the ways in which so many, and I guess all, well, not all, but many horror films do this, but, especially.
Well, I think it's pointed because, lately we've had a lot of, horror as grief, you know?
Right.
It's just a lot of like, if you kill the sister or the parents or the grandparent, that's an easy way to get the viewers in the same sort of emotional state as a main character that you're trying to get into a vulnerable state.
Right. It kicks it off with that sort of...
I mean, this I think is a little different in that he's a widower. I mean, I guess recently we've had The Lodge, which was sort of similar, but like...
Not the same.
I mean, obviously Audition's much better.
Yeah. But, I mean, so it lays the groundwork for that atmosphere of loss. And also just the fact is that, you know, this is a film that will go into, I think the central subject really is, you know, the relationship between men and women and male anxieties about women and all of these various things.
Yeah, I think in particular how that applies to Japanese culture as well.
Yeah. So this, I mean...
Although,
this...
you know, the whole older man with a younger woman thing is... That's not specific to Japan. That's obviously America. And Europe and everywhere else.
Right. Well, here's something interesting. I was reading this really insightful essay about Audition by the, you know, the late critic Robin Wood. And he basically said that while much of Audition is specific to Japan, structurally, and he says, you know, obviously in terms of plot and character, they are very, very, very different. But right. structurally, the structure of the story of Audition has a large similarity to the structure of Hitchcock's Vertigo, right? Which is, you know, it's one of my favorite films, and it's this obviously acclaimed film. And he says that the recurrence of this structure suggests that even separated by vast cultural and historical differences in time periods and context, this specific type of story, which seems to recur, despite obviously radically different specifics, suggests that something about it is something that is shared between Japan and the U.S. as sort of very patriarchal, conservative, capitalist societies.
Yeah, I mean, I
societies.
Think it's that view that as a man you deserve a wife, and not just deserve a wife, but you deserve a young or youngish, pretty wife who will cook and clean and basically, you know, like facilitate your happiness.
Right. You know, and it's interesting because the protagonist in this film, as with the protagonist in Vertigo, he's not portrayed as this horrible male chauvinist figure who's like, who hates women or views women as objects or anything.
No, it's much more subtle the way they do it, the way they show. I mean, for instance, I think the great tragedy of this film that they show is that there are a number of women around this man who want to get together with him, like be an item, and he just doesn't, he just has no desire. But like and I don't remember that's... exactly who, but I believe it's, there's a coworker and maybe a maid that both are like,
right,
you should, and they've either had suggestions of a romantic relationship or maybe just like a hint that maybe the coworker, for instance, wants to get together, and he just sort of doesn't see it or doesn't want it.
Right. Well, that's actually one of the main similarities that Robin Wood notes with Vertigo, in that in Vertigo, obviously, you know, the protagonist, Scotty, is pursuing this mysterious woman, Madeline, the blonde, you know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, in his, he sort of is close friends with this other woman, Midge, who's a little less glamorous. They're friends. They were engaged at one point, but it broke off. And in this film, you know, the protagonist has this office coworker who we later learn in a sort of dreamlike hallucinatory sequence. They had sex at a party one time, and she is sort of, you know, you get the sense that she or the babysitter, who it also appears that he had sex with at one point.
Yeah.
You know, they might be the more suitable or sensible partners, right? Like,
I don't know how old the babysitter was, but yes.
Yeah. But, you know, the people in his life that it would make sense, you know, they take care of the kids, or they work together, or, you know, they're familiar in some way. But instead, the protagonist chases this more idealistic version of a woman who we learn both in Vertigo and in Audition to be something of a deception in different ways, obviously. But
I think it also gets into, I don't think this is true, but there is that prevailing sentiment of like, if you're an older person, don't date a younger person because they're crazy.
This sort of
just takes it to its logical end of like, well, what if they actually were crazy?
Yes. Yeah. No. Yeah. But let's just get into the main conceit.
Yeah. So
right?
basically, so... some time has passed.
His son has grown up.
His son is now, almost going to college. I think he's maybe a senior in high school.
Yeah. So, and has this, it's a recurring thing for me. It's never really, it's not integral to the plot, but I find it amusing. Like, the son is just weirdly obsessed with dinosaurs. Like,
yeah, he is, and that's never, there's no payoff to it. I mean,
he's just a character quirk,
just like,
I guess.
Oh man, I'm going to go to the museum and find out about this dinosaur. But you assume it's like 10 years later.
Right.
I'm going to have trouble reading this. Shigeharu.
Aoyama.
Aoyama? Is that the...
Yeah, that's how he's referred to. It's a mispronunciation, but let's just say Aoyama, because
let's just say Aoyama, yeah. So, Aoyama, yeah, I mean, he's, I still don't really know what he does for a job, to be honest.
No, he's sort of, it's ambiguous, but he's sort of, it's like some generic office work type thing, and he seems to work with this, or be friends with this film producer. I'm sorry. I'm gonna shut my window because there's a guy outside.
Oh yeah, that's fine.
Okay, I'll be right back. All right, I'm back. You might still hear him, but
that's fine. I should be able to cut that out. And if not, it doesn't really.
Okay, so
doesn't really matter.
Yeah, well, I'll just pick it up where we were. So yeah, he seems to work at some sort of generic, ambiguous office type location. It's never quite, I mean, maybe they mention it at one point, but it's never quite clear.
Just all-purpose office job was what I thought.
Yeah, and I don't know if he works with his friend, but he has a close friend who's a film producer, Yoshikawa, and he, you know, the plot starts to gestate when he basically... They go out to a bar together, right? And they're sort of talking about, you know, Aoyama's getting up there in age. Not up there, but he's middle-aged.
Yeah, he seems like maybe 45 to 50.
Yeah, yes. And we've seen, you know, in his home with his son that, you know, he's basically fulfilling, you know, he's cleaning the dishes, he's sort of, you know, lonely, and the fact that his son is going off to college sooner or later is going to leave him alone. So there's already this...
Yeah, in a real tragic way, it's almost the son who gets him into dating again. Well, it wouldn't be tragic if, you know, he didn't get his foot cut off, But he's like, Dad, you should get... It's funny the way he says it. He says, Dad, you should get married again. Instead of just, Dad, you should date again.
Yeah, yeah. It's not... which is... I guess that's reflective of Japanese culture in a way, maybe. In that it's just marriage. Marriage is what makes sense. But, I mean, we have those things here as well. It's just, I guess... I don't know. It seems culturally specific in some ways, but he's talking with his friend at the bar, and it's really great. Like, they're talking about like what type of woman Aoyama should find, right? And in this shot, there's a lot of interesting shots in the film. It's sort of at the one end of the bar, and they're sort of passively looking at a woman who's sitting there, right? And they're talking about like, oh, Aoyama wants a girl who plays piano, you know? He wants somebody sort of fancy. And there's this woman right in the foreground, but she's totally out of focus. Like, it's focused squarely on the two men just talking about it. Which I thought was such a great, visual summation of the relationship. Not just of what they're talking about, but of the relationship where the woman is sort of this unfocused object of desire, and the men are just like looking and talking about it and discussing it.
And there's an interesting thing too that happens in the bar where there's just some, and I don't know, I mean, to a Westerner, I didn't think anything was wrong, but there were these women that were just being like vaguely loud in a bar, and they're like, ugh, trash. That's sort of
Yeah.
I think that was probably more specifically Japanese culture based.
Yeah, they say something about like women today are so, you know, vulgar or something like that, I think, which is that definitely feels like.
Yeah, I mean, that is probably where it differs a bit from, you know, American, because we as Americans are used to just like the loudest, most obnoxious people on earth. So.
right. Yeah, but it's. It's this sort of thing, and then Yoshikawa proposes right off the bat the sort of central conceit of the film, which is, oh, I know what will happen. I'm a film producer. I'm going to cast a film for, like, you know, Japan's next talented woman or whatever, right? And we're going to interview a bunch of women, and you can, you know, they're actually auditioning for the part of your wife, you know? They're not, you know, it's they're thinking they're auditioning for a role, but they're auditioning to be your partner, and then I'll cast someone, and out of any of the women that are rejected, you can take your pick, right?
Right. Like, he makes a point to say, well, I'll get the main one you pick. He says, no, you don't want her. She's going to be too, too hard to handle. Basically, she's going to have aspirations
the piano
that aren't going to line up with you.
Right. He says you can't have a real actress or a real talented person with you. You need somebody who's sort of
vaguely talented.
Yeah. Which is interesting. In the next scene, he gets the portfolio of women who are auditioning, who have been selected, and they've each written an essay, and he sort of flips through each one of them. And interestingly, at this point, he turns away the photo of his wife, right? So that's, it's really important in that way, in that, like, you get the sense that he is aware that this whole, let's just say it flatly, that this idea is pretty creepy and manipulative to do to women, like, you know.
It is. I don't maybe think you should get your foot cut off for it, but
No.
You know, it's not okay. I'm sure it does happen to an extent.
Right. Maybe not people. This exact way, but...
Yeah, but, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of... I mean, as we know from the news, there are plenty of predatory people in Hollywood, so...
Yeah.
Just leave it at that.
It is interesting within that context, but... but he's aware, like, Yoshikawa seems pretty shameless about the whole thing, but Aoyama feels like an element of internal anxiety about it that is clearly present when he turns the photo of his wife away. But he's sort of flipping through the women and their essays, and he lights upon one woman, Asami, who is a beautiful woman. She, I believe actually the actress was a model prior to this movie, and this was
her
first.
It would make sense, yeah.
Yeah. He reads her essay, and it's this very sad essay about how she always wanted to be a ballet dancer, but then her hip was broken, and, you know, her dreams were ruined, right? And in a really perverse and sort of misogynistic way, I feel like that is the type of woman that Yoshikawa was telling Aoyama to find. Like, a woman who's talented, but who can't actually use that talent.
Yeah, like, someone who is smart enough that they can have, like, you know, say, be a piano player or...
Right, but their hands are broken.
They could be a ballet dancer, but that they can't actually do it, or they don't really want to pursue it, because then they'll be too, you know, career driven.
Yeah, which is, it's creepy that the broken rib, basically, or
the
hip,
bone.
Yeah. The broken hip bone is sort of the thing that, you know, makes her an attainable asset, you know, for him. So,
and I would add to,
it's not a fetishistic thing.
I'm trying to word this in the best way.
Right.
It's not like a fetishistic thing. It's not coming down on somebody who thinks, like, I don't know, someone with a severed arm is like
hot.
Arousing. It's more literally just the that she can't.
No, yeah, it's
perform ballet. It's not like a fetish thing.
No. Yeah, and I'm saying, and I'm also just sort of extrapolating this because it's not. He doesn't say this in the film, and he does seem to truly.
No, but it is subtext. I mean, there's a reason he picked the wounded ballet dancer.
But it's also, he does seem to find her obviously beautiful, and her essay is very poetic.
It's well written. Yeah, I think what it is about it too is there's probably a sadness to it that he can relate to as a widower.
Yeah.
And maybe he doesn't see in the other women that are trying to be a little more like
a certain worldliness or wisdom.
Which,
you know, and it ends, I think it ends with the line something like, you know, I understand that life is about moving towards death, which is a portentous line, although he does not realize it at the time. But yeah, so this is the woman he's most interested in seeing.
Yeah.
And then we get into a really masterful
audition sequence. Proper. Yes. This is a great montage.
I love it.
It's great because on the one hand, you're just like, what a bunch of schmucks, like with the male producers. But then on the other hand, you sort of see like,
well, the film puts you in their position. Yeah,
right. I mean, you're seeing these women in just little blips of like, you know,
comedic like, moments.
Yeah,
or
just like they're trying to, you know, they're doing an audition. They're trying to like sell themselves and like what they're what they're into and how they are.
Yeah, yeah. It's great. I mean, there's a lot going on. I love how like the first shot is very stark. Like it's this chair and then the windows are just the shutters are closing. It has almost like a jail like feel. And then I really, the way it's done is so artful to me. Like, basically, you get three types of shots in this sequence, this first sequence. You get a two-shot of the men, right?
Yeah.
You know, them sitting together asking questions, right? Frontally.
Yeah.
Then you get a frontal shot of the woman in the chair, right?
Yeah.
You know, just a like distanced neutral. Like, it's not a commentating shot. It's just, you know, it's like, you know, an audition camera, like just how it's positioned, right? And then at the same time, occasionally you get intercut another camera that's in the room that is sort of lasciviously panning over the women's bodies, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
And that, to me, it's showing you the men, it's showing you the woman, and then it's showing you the gaze of the men. Like,
right, how, it's like the literal male gaze.
Yeah, what's actually going on. And I thought that was so artful, like, and simply demonstrated. And it is also just, you know, it is perverse and creepy, but at the same time, it's a very funny.
I mean,
it's a
like,
funny sequence.
I can't remember off the top of my head, but like, you know, there's one of them that's like, something like, I'm a porn star, and she just gets naked. And
yeah, right.
There's
another
one that, I mean, there's just like a number of tragic women.
Yeah. It's, and you know, homely women
and like
dancers.
Yeah. Doesn't one of them try to tap dance?
Yeah, that's one of the funnier moments where she just sort of just starts tap dancing. It's a comedic montage, and intentionally so.
Yeah.
It even has that, and I thought, by the way, I really like the score to this film overall, but the music during this scene is sort of like almost like game show music, or like just this sort of casual jazzy string section where it's, you know, it has this sort of pageantry quality to it.
Yeah, definitely. It's a lot. You know, it's interesting this was made in 99 because, as we saw, you know, that we got the rise of at least in America, the rise of America's Got Talents, you know, American Idol.
Right.
Masked Singer now. We're starting to scrape the bottom of the barrel in terms of the talent pool.
Yeah, it's getting pretty weird out here with some of these shows, but
The Mask. I've never watched The Masked Singer, but some of you guys dress like mascots, and then some of you are celebrities. Okay,
right. Like basically, they dress somebody up. You know, people do sing and dance routines, right? And they're dressed in like a horrible mascot costume, and then the judges have to guess who it is, and it's always
like, I feel like we should go so far the other way and just get like really prolific serial murderers and put them in these costumes.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh my god, you're the guy that shot up the Colorado Theater, and he's like, yeah, they let me out to sing for one day.
Yeah, I mean, that would at least be you know,
that would
interestingly
at least have some sort
grotesque
of morbid interest for me, but as it stands, it's like, yeah, I don't care about.
I mean, they did have
Nick
Sarah
Cannon
Palin.
Or
they did have Sarah Palin, so that is sort of close to a psychotic.
What was her? Was she like a wolf or something?
I forget. It's just very bizarre. It's always like C-list celebrities.
Of course
and
it is. I mean, I don't think anybody, even B-list, would be willing to do it.
Yeah, no.
But it is. So yeah, it's similar. It's sort of predicting the rise of the talentless talent. I mean, that's rude, but you know, like the fairly talented talent, but not the incredibly talented talent.
And it shows also how sinister and exploitative those things are beneath the surface.
Into just the nature of acting and producers and there's always, even when it's on the up and up, there's always this vaguely predatory quality to it of like, you know, we like your eyes, but we don't like your cheeks. We like her legs, but we don't like how she talks.
Right. And they're asking some pretty intrusive questions.
Yeah,
like,
they're definitely intrusive.
How often do you have sex a week? Have you ever prostituted yourself? Like these very, you know, obviously questions designed more for, you know, the part of Aoyama's new wife than the acting part auditioning for. But anyway, so, you know, this goes on. Aoyama doesn't comment that much. It's actually Yoshikawa who's doing most of the talking. And then Asami walks in. And this, you know what I was talking about earlier, where it's the frontal shots of the women and the frontal shots of the men?
Yeah, this is the first one that sort of does a pan.
Yeah, and furthermore, we start behind Asami, that we look over her shoulder. So all of a sudden,
you're right.
That,
yeah, this is like the first time you get a POV from someone else.
Yeah, so the gaze, you know, the women who were being looked at in the chair, this person is looking back. Like this person is looking back, which is
the
first.
Yeah, and in retrospect, that's a big.
Yeah, it's
a big clue, but at the time, you just think of it like, oh, this is the main romantic
pan. Yeah, because
so.
it sort of tracks into Aoyama's face, and he's sort of love-struck and everything. But it's actually a very sinister and interesting shot in retrospect. But I mean, this is the first time he actually starts asking questions, and he talks about like, oh, you know, I was really moved by your essay, and you know, when you said that stuff about death or whatever, I knew you were a smart girl. Like I knew you knew stuff about life and everything. And she's very demure and passive. She's just like, thank you. You know, she doesn't really comment. She seems pretty shy and intimidated by the whole thing.
And then, you know, going back to Handmaiden, that sort of, that sort of fake demureness or like fake innocence.
Right. Yeah. The deception behind it. And Vertigo too, where the woman who seems like she's an object to be rescued is actually a snare to entrap the protagonist. But anyway, so he decides to call her that night because we get the sense she's the only one he's seriously contemplating. And they go out for dinner, right? I watched this film twice, by the way, but it happened last week. So if I skip over,
I think I saw this a week and a half ago. So
okay. So they basically
my order of things is a little fuzzy.
Right. We do also get, you know, in between these scenes, brief interludes of the, you know, the son bringing home a girl from school, right? And
or talking about dinosaurs, yeah.
And talking about dinosaurs, right? And the son says stuff like, you know, women scare me or something like that, you know? Where he's like, you know, he evinces a similar anxiety of women to his father, but they, you know, there's, it's interesting. I like watching the sort of, I mean, what Wood refers to as the gestures of male complicity in this movie, where like you know, the son brings a girlfriend home and she's looking at the dinosaur book, and then Aoyama just gives him like an okay sign and a wink, and the son like nods too, like, and you see how like there's this whole other code entirely independent of the woman that is being passed around between these men about the woman they're having sex with.
Yeah, I mean, and there's definitely a father-son thing too that
right.
You know, yeah. It's like the father wants the son to do well. He also wants him to
meet
it's
girls.
It's sort of like the it's like there's a father-son, but then a man-to-man type of thing.
Yeah, well, it's just something in male relationships, or heterosexual male relationships.
Yeah, there's that sort of angle of like, you're gonna, you know, do the thing, and I don't know, and you're like, do the thing, all
right.
Yeah, that is sort of a low-level complicit, this vaguely skeevy, yeah.
Yeah, because we later learn in a hallucinatory montage that the father seems to have sexual interest in the girl as well.
I didn't even piece that together. That's the same girl.
Oh, yeah, no. There's a scene later in the film where the man hallucinating is getting blowjobs from a female who changes shape into various women.
Yeah.
And one of the shapes...
I think one of them is his wife, and then it's... I think
one of them is his wife. One of them is...
Yeah.
Asame. And one of them is this girl that his son brought home. Anyway. So they basically... They start going to dinner, and... I mean, I find the editing... I had to rewatch it to get a handle, because... This film seems to condense a lot of different things into sort of a blur, you know, like they sort of switch restaurants, and then in one shot the restaurant is full, but in a later shot it's like an empty restaurant, right? And
signify that it's been a number of days.
Yeah. It's you get the sense that time is being condensed, but you know, there's nothing unsettling in these scenes for a while. I mean,
it is more or less romantic comedy territory. It's like, we're going to go out to eat again, and we're having nice conversations. And I believe is there voiceover? I don't.
Well, it's sort of the dialogue from one carries over to the next.
More or less Ayami is being like, I love this woman.
Yeah. But his friend Yoshikawa, the guy who introduced him to her in the first place, suddenly has second thoughts. He said, look, I called the place where she said she went with this music producer, and he died 15 years or disappeared, I should say. Right. And, you know, you should take it steady and not, you know, you don't want to appear too needy. Right. So this was really stupid for me. But, you know, there's the scene with the two of them playing golf on a roof. Right. And this is where Yoshikawa is sort of telling him, be careful and don't come on too strong, and don't call her for a while, is what he's saying. And the shot is framed in such a weird way. It's right on the ground, and it's these golf balls scattered all over the ground, and the men are in the background blurred. And I had this like ridiculous thought that this was meant to be an almost like a masculine symbol, if you catch my drift, of like, you know, sort of like, testicles or something.
Right. Yeah, obviously. Yeah.
But I thought that was absurd. But also at the same time, you know, it's emphasized so much, and the fact that at the start of the scene, Aoyama, like, sort of whacks one of the golf balls at the net, but it fails to go through the hole. And it's almost like this impotence, you know, this sort of impotent image. But I thought that was a little too, I don't know, film major of me, but it was a little, I just found the framing interesting there. But I mean,
and it is funny too when you get very analytical, you try to look for all the symbolism and things. It could have easily just been he thought it was interesting to frame it starting with the balls.
Yeah, no, it's as good a way to frame it as anyway.
I think there might be something to that. Yeah, the fact that they're talking about this sort of like. I've never agreed with this, but there are these rules that men will tell you about, at least heterosexual men, about dating and what you should do with women, where it's like, well, don't call her immediately because then they'll know that they like you. Or I guess in this modern age, it would be don't text back immediately.
Yeah. Which are just, it's really, it's sometimes it's sensible, but in this case, it feels more like a gesture of dominance in a way. Like, okay,
yeah, it's like, you know,
you don't want to be the needy womanly figure. You want.
I mean,
her
I think
be.
This what this movie gets into, is the sort of like midlife crisis type of stuff, like that sort of desire for youth and maybe to. Like, oh, well, I have a chance to start over. Why wouldn't I start over with someone younger? And sort of the pratfalls that come along with that.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, and there's nothing inherently unsympathetic about Aoyama wanting a wife.
I mean, he's like, what I like about his portrayal, especially on this rewatch, is I realize, like, he's not a great guy, but they portray him as not a great guy in a realistic way. Instead of a movie villain way. Like, he's not a great guy because, like, for instance, his coworker is like, do you want to go out to dinner? And he doesn't even entertain it. He's just like, no.
Yeah, he's just sort of, he's very cold to her and everything, but
yeah,
he's not a bad person.
He's just very, I guess, myopic when it comes to his dating life.
Yeah. And Yoshikawa seems to be more distinctly a kind of creepy, you know, weirdo figure.
Yeah, Yoshikawa seems like he's supposed to be portrayed as sort of a vaguely sleazy producer. Like, he probably has sex with some of the people he casts.
But the thing is, I mean, you know, that's what's very realistic to me about this film's portrayal of male chauvinism, in that it's not, for him, for Aoyama, it's not a malicious act. Like, there's nothing wrong with him wanting to have a wife, and there's nothing even necessarily wrong, you know, with him wanting to have a younger wife. I mean, they seem to get along well, and it can be fulfilling and everything.
Yeah,
but...
sorry, hold on 1 second. My cat's going to be knocking shit over if I don't give her a treat, so I'll be right back.
That's okay.
God, I swear, man, it's like, sometimes stuff goes smoothly, like last night, and then there are times like today where I get 2 phone calls within 20 minutes, both spam, I would add.
Dear.
Because it's like 508, but it's no one I know from Massachusetts.
Right.
And then my cat, since I didn't feed her a treat this morning, she's doing this thing because she knows it'll work, where she hops onto the table where the sound cage is, and she starts to, like, press against the cardboard. Like, she's, like, right next to me pressing into the cardboard, which is edging closer to the microphone.
It's clever. That's clever. It's clever.
She's smart, but she's a pain in the ass. Can't wait to get a dumb dog someday. But yeah, let's count it back in just so I can track to here. Counting down with five and four and three and two and one.
So yeah, I mean, there's nothing inherently wrong about Aoyama wanting a new wife. Obviously, there's nothing wrong with that.
I think if anything, the film might. If it has any kind of moral stance, the stance might be that, like, if you're an older person, maybe go for someone closer to your age.
Perhaps, yeah, which would certainly be in line with, you know, a lot of Japanese and Western standards about marriage and relationships.
I don't necessarily agree with that, but I do think in this case they are sort of, that's why they have these other love interests that are closer to his age that would be perfectly suitable.
Right.
That's sort of a counterpoint to, like,
this young, mysterious woman who he is manipulating. I mean, and that's the guilt. I mean, he's manipulating. He's misled this woman. You know, it might not be, you know, a harmful, like,
I guess it gets into casual misogyny a bit. Because it's like he has had sex, I think, with one of the love interests. And then just more or less didn't call her back and was just
doesn't even talk to her. And
it's not like that's, you know, I mean, I don't want to get into
it's not the worst.
Like, gender politics and dating too much. But, like, there's nothing inherent, like, you know, consenting adults, shit happens.
Yeah. Ghosting is not abuse, but it is, you see a sort of pattern of casually, not even actively cruel, but
well, it's within the normal
behavior.
Social it's within the normal social hierarchy. Like, it's normalized. Right. I mean, it's normalized in Western culture, too. Like, you know, if you're a man of a certain type, like, no one bats an eye if you just, like, serial date and, like, just, you know,
date some woman
for, like, 2 weeks and then dump her and move on to the next. And
Yeah. And, the audition is also just overtly creepy.
Yeah, the audition, I think, is an overt example of what is maybe a less overt phenomenon.
Pattern of behavior.
Yeah, pattern of behavior.
But, I mean, basically, she, you know, he decides to stop calling her for a time. And that night he has a bad dream, right? Of his wife.
The dream sequences are so interesting in where they're placed.
Yeah, because just as he's, and I didn't notice this till round two, obviously, because twist I wasn't aware of didn't
right,
come.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's sort of sleeping and thinking about his wife. And at the same time, intercut is a very eerie, this is the first, like, horror jolt, very eerie shot of Asami hunched over with that, you know, that long, drapey black hair that we associate with J-horror movies.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can see sort of her spine in a way, like, you can see her bones, yeah. And she's just sitting by the telephone waiting for her to call him.
Don't we see a little bit of the bag in the background?
Yeah, there's
too.
A bag, a big bag in the background, and I believe at the end of the shot,
it sort
kicks
of like,
and rolls over, which is, you
I
know,
remember when I first saw this, that was like the first moment. I was like, what the fuck? Like,
yeah, no, it's very creepy. It's a creepy moment. But
it almost
again,
goes surrealist, even though later we find out it's weirdly I guess we can get into that whether that's
I mean, okay, let's I'd like to talk about that when we get to the specific revelation, but you know, we can debate what how much of this is really happening and how much of it seems to take place within a very subjective consciousness, but but anyway, but it's also interesting that the next time, you know, he tries to call her, you know, he reaches out to the phone, right? And we get another shot of her, right? As, you know, it's cut, like, he reaches out to the phone and he stares at it, right? And then we get a shot of her waiting by the phone again. And then we cut back to him. And he pulls his hand away, but then he calls her, right? So that's another, that placement is very purposeful, right? Because there's an ambiguity there. Like, it could be him thinking about that, like, or an image from his dream or whatever, or it could just be an actual, there's an ambiguity to that. But eventually.
By the way, this actor Ryu Ishibashi does a great job of being.
Yes, yeah.
Being simultaneously sympathetic, but also, like, vaguely obnoxious.
Yeah. It's he's a, you know, he's a sympathetic character in some ways, but
he feels like a real human being is what I like.
Right.
Because he's not sympathetic, but that sort of sympathetic where it doesn't seem like a real person, where they're just like, I'm just here to be sympathetic.
A victim, yeah, or whatever. It's good because he,
like, you don't want what happens to him to happen to him, but at the same time, you sort of are like, well, part of you is like, maybe you deserved it.
Right. Well, you know, maybe it's him who thinks he deserves it, but we'll talk about that later. So they pick up dating again, and they go to a seaside hotel, and he's going to plan on marrying her, and then we get a really beautiful and delicately filmed love sequence where this has really moved into full on romantic territory at this point. I mean, just no hints of horror or danger yet or anything outside
of this.
This
is what
ominous
makes it honestly a more effective horror movie is that it doesn't try to force it. It's like, it can be a romantic movie for a lot of it.
Yeah. Well, it's really, like, it's so hard to pull off these sorts of radical tone shifts where in the first half, it's sort of a slightly cracked, off-kilter comedy,
I mean,
right?
The thing is, when people do this. It's one of my favorite things that people do in not only, you know, films, but in shows or books. Right. I just love that ability to kind of genre shift, like, and it just seems organic. But I will say when people try to do it and it's very forced and not done well, I don't think there's anything worse.
Yeah, no, it's really, really hard to accomplish, but I feel like this movie pulls it off marvelously because you're just with Mike
as a director as well. He's just so versatile that, you know, he can operate in those modes.
Right. But it's this very beautiful scene, blue lighting and great use of the bed frame, which has these sort of like curly, snake-like frames or whatever. She sort of lies down on the bed.
Is this the first time they have sex?
Yes, yeah.
I do think it's sort of funny that he's, you know, like, we've been more or less waiting for him to have sex. Like, you know, because
right.
And yet when it's starting to happen, he's like, we should really go for dinner, you know? Like, he seems like a scared teenager.
Well, yeah, no, he's actually the, he's sort of, she lies down on the bed and he's just sort of standing above her.
Just sort of doing the like collaring, like, oh, what about the dessert? I mean.
Right. And he's like, you know, staring at her in the same way that, you know. I guess that does get into the anxiety of a middle-aged man dating younger women or whatever.
You know what I realized also in retrospect is, like, he's probably had sex with, obviously he's had sex with some people, but, like, I saw it as, like, it's probably been a while since he's,
Well, he's
had sex with anyone he actually cared about as well.
Parenting his son and, you know, it's just, it's been a while. So, yeah, I mean, and then she sort of pulls back her, you know, garment and
I mean, I think part of it too is probably a cultural thing because it's like in Japan and I apologize listeners if it's just like insensitive because I don't really know that much, but I assume it's sort of a traditional patriarchal, like the man initiates sex sort of a thing.
Right.
So this is probably like freaking him out on a number of levels because he's like, oh shit. Like,
but she still is assuming the passive posture.
Yeah,
that's
true. Yeah. There is a passive, you know, it's not like she's like hopping on top of him. She's like laying down.
Well, that's the thing. Well, she's lying down, right? And she pulls back her garment and you see two scars, right? Like burn scars, which are important regardless of what you take away from the film, right? And she says, you know, pledge your love to me and nobody else. And he agrees, very clearly moved. And then he sits down on the bed, like, looks like they're ready to have sex. And then, you know, you said, you know, she's lying prone passive, right? And then suddenly it looks like she flips over, right? Like that the position swaps under the sheets, right?
Yeah.
And then we cut, right? Hard cut. It's the morning, right? This confused me the first time I saw it, which is purposeful. But I was like, okay, what was the implication there? Like, did they have sex?
Is the implication that they had sex in between, or?
Yeah, I don't know. Did they fall asleep? But he wakes up in the morning, and she's nowhere to be found. She's just disappeared. But, you know, and he's really profoundly affected by this, right? Like, where did she go?
Well, yeah, because he's fallen in love with this woman and they finally consummated and, like, you know, in a typical, not even in a movie, in a typical just life, it would be like, oh, now we're going to really get into it. And she's just gone.
Gone, yeah. So he's lonely for a few days. You know, he says, you know, there's a great scene with Yoshikawa who's like, you know, I told you so. And he says, like, do you think of me as like a sad middle-aged old man who got, like, you know, tricked by a younger girl? Like, he's, and it's clearly like a real point of shame for him, like, because he feels like he's been made a fool of in some way, but he knows what he felt for Asami was real, so he keeps searching.
Yeah, I think some of the tragedy of this movie too is like, it really is the story of a man who's finally letting his guard down and able to love someone again, and then that person happens to be a murderous psychopath.
Yeah, it's Well, we'll talk about it, but it's definitely, you know, you get the sense of how wounded he must be after finding this person that he loves, although finding her through rather unscrupulous means.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, he's found this person and they've, you know, he suddenly lost her. So he goes searching for her, and there's a lot of dead ends, but it's actually, he decides to go to the dance studio where she said she trained as a child to be a dancer, right?
Yeah.
And this is where things, so I noticed for the, as he's walking up to the dance building, right? It's this sort of, the camera angle is tilted, right?
Yeah.
And there's this weird yellow gradient applied to the sky, like a very noticeable gradient where it makes it look very artificial, right?
Yeah.
And then when he enters the dance studio, it's this sort of lurid purple and orange lighting, like very stylized. And you start to see that in this portion of the movie, things suddenly start to become much more colorful, much less naturalistic in terms of how it's shot, like whether it's Dutch angles or these sort
now,
of
do
weird...
you think that's supposed to mimic his mental state?
Yeah, and I think definitely it's meant to mimic his mental state, also to draw the audience into the increasing strangeness of the story, but also, you know, it pertains certainly to the ambiguous twist of this film in interesting ways. But he goes into this dance studio and there's this guy playing the piano, right? Just a creepy old man playing the piano in a wheelchair.
In a wheelchair, yes.
We later see that he has prosthetic feet, you know, they're fake just feet.
Probably some of the creepiest prosthetic feet. Like, I don't, it looks like they're made of clay with just like wooden
supports.
Yeah, or
like paper mache. Yeah, it's
just like, I don't know who made him these. You get the sense maybe he made them himself.
Yeah, they're detailed in a way that you don't really see with like plastic prosthetics, but it's creepy. And he's a creepy guy. Like,
yes, he's
you know,
a very creepy guy.
Ayumi is just asking, like, have you heard anything of her? Like, where has she been or whatever?
One of his first questions, like, have you had sex with her?
Yeah, one of the teacher's first questions, yeah? Or Ayumi.
The teacher,
Oh, yeah, no, that's what he says, yeah. No, he turns around and does that sort of creepy laugh out of horror movies, and he wheels up to him.
I mean, again,
like,
I haven't seen enough Asian cinema to know if this is a thing, but having seen Handmaiden recently, it is
the glasses.
It's strikingly similar in terms of, like, old weird man character that's lecherous and vaguely abusive.
Well, we find out that,
overtly abusive. Yeah, they're both overtly. It's not vaguely.
A flashback to the Asami's childhood as, you know, somebody who is taught by this man, and he is revealed to have branded her with I don't know what they are exactly, but, metal needles is some kind.
I think metal needles, something
like
that.
Or tongs, you know, like, and he burned her thigh, right? So clearly she was abused by this man as a child. And he sort of laughs in Ayama's face, and Ayama is just perplexed. So he leaves. He's like, you know, nothing to be found here. So then next he goes to the bar where she claimed to work, right? And it's the sort of empty, here again we have weird lighting. We have this like sort of pink neon light that suffuses every corner of the bar. And
yes.
Nobody's there, and he turns around and there's this guy at the top of the stairs who's like, oh, you know, the owner was murdered and dismembered. And they never found who did it or something. And the interesting thing is that the police found 3 extra fingers, an extra ear, and an extra tongue that didn't belong to the owner, right? So who could it be? And at this point, it's a weird, you know, I didn't know what to make of it. It cuts and Aoyama looks and he sees this sort of kind of grotesque comic, like apparition of the tongue wagging on the floor. Like, what do you make of this moment? He looks.
You know, I'll admit this was, it had been a number of years since I saw Audition. And then I saw it a couple of weeks ago. It definitely still throws me for a loop because it makes me wonder if that's supposed to, the tongue's wagging. So I don't think it's supposed to be real.
No.
But if it's supposed, I think it's supposed to be in his head.
Right. Like he's picturing imagining this it. In reaction to the story. Right. Which it really does throw you off. Because...
But it is, it's almost played as if it's like some sort of haunting. Like maybe the images are just coming to him from the room itself.